Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What are you up to on either Friday, August the 12th, or Saturday, August the 13th? What about getting a group together and maybe doing a road trip? Coming up to Wodonga and or Albury, because I'm doing two shows up there with my very dear friend Helen Rose, a New South Wales policewoman. I'm going right outside my comfort zone big time because Helen and I talk very personally about our different paths to PTSD. But the result was the same because we overcame some major hurdles. It's not all doom and gloom. It's about giving hope to those who think there is no hope. Helen and I are testament to the fact that you can manage PTSD and life does get better. The show is called The Consequences of Murder. On Friday, it's at the Thirsty Crow in Wagga Wagga. On Saturday, it's at the SSSA Club in Albury, and tickets are through Eventbrite. It's adults only, and 7 p.m. is the usual starting time. Okay, thanks, and look forward to seeing you, hopefully. Bye. Hello, and thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime. And just a couple of things I'd like to ask you to consider. Firstly, my guests share their personal stories, which others may see differently. No one will see a situation the same. It's just human nature. Secondly, my podcasts aren't suitable for children and some adults for that matter, so please consider if it's right for you and contact Lifeline or any other support service if you find yourself affected by my subject matter.
How could someone put a body in there? How the hell could you do that?
In 2004, I was a detective with Missing Persons Unit, along with my guest today then, Detective Senior Constable Kira Olney. But now she's just plain Kira Olney. We've both rarely shared much about the investigation we're going to talk about today with each other because it's just so painful on so many levels. It was only recently it happened. And in today's podcast, we talk about our respective recollections about the Mornington Monster, John Sharp, and the different things that we remember, but also the things that we witness together, which we will both never forget. You know, sometimes we've got no control over our emotions, and it took years for the effects of this investigation to come to the surface for me. But many, many more years later did it hit Kira. And it hit her like a brick. And that's what we're talking about today. Police, and in this case detectives, with delayed reactions, delayed shock, detectives who see humanity at its worst. And while we're trying to stay strong for others, we're struggling to remain strong within ourselves. But sometimes when you think you've put all those emotions away, they come out of nowhere, completely uninvited and unexpected, and they bite you on the backside. Black Salmon Events organised a ticketed event at the State Library last year, when we could all be with our friends and actually sit next to each other, where I gave a presentation about the Mornington Monster, John Sharp. And Kira and her sisters, a niece and two close friends, came along to support me and the event. I'd often spoken about this case as I found it wasn't just interesting to the audience, but it was cathartic for me as well. And I wanted the public, and I still do, I want the public to appreciate the difficulties that investigators often face. And boy, was this one up there. Any investigation involving a small child takes any investigation to another level, rightly or wrongly, but I think we all get that. So I'd love to welcome my dear friend, Kira Olney, to the microphone. Hello, Kira.
Hello, Narelle. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing in ISO?
Yeah, it's wearing thin. It's wearing thin, but it's nice to, but like everyone else. But it's nice to talk to you, and the sun is shining, so can't complain.
That's nice. That's nice. Yeah, it is up here too. So, yes, at least we're alive to see it, I suppose. So you obviously heard my intro.
Yes.
And so I thought we might start. So for those who've lived underground and not have heard of this investigation, I thought that between us we might share with our audience and give them a brief summary of the case. And then I thought you might talk about those recollections that you experienced at the Black Salmon event. So I thought, could we start with you explaining a bit about the role of the Missing Persons Unit within Victoria Police?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's changed a little. It's sort of changed from year to year, really. But when we were there, so back in the early 2000s, we were basically a team of within the homicide squad, and we monitored all the reported missing persons in the state. That was quite a bit. So we sort of had oversight of any missing persons cases that might have been a little bit suspicious, or they needed the local detectives might have needed a hand with some resourcing, that sort of thing. So we received hundreds of reports over each year, and you obviously get those ones that come in. You think, there's something not quite right here. And a lot of the time, you did go on your gut instincts, and things just that stood out, that credit cards hadn't been accessed, or that it took 3 weeks for the person that was reporting the missing person missing. That was always a bit of a alarm bells if it was a couple of weeks delayed, all that sort of stuff. So whenever our analyst saw a missing person's report that sort of wasn't quite right, then, we'd have a bit of a powwow and work out whether we needed to sort of take over the investigation or at least make some initial inquiries. So that was when we received this job. It was back in March 2004, and we received a report regarding an unexplained disappearance of Anna Sharp and her 17-month-old daughter, Gracie. So that was the start of it, I suppose, yeah.
And you know, you're right about the gut instincts. It's incredible, isn't it, with all those different jobs that come into the missing persons unit. We do all, and I think all of us get that gut feeling that something, sometimes it may not be obvious, but sometimes you just get that gut feeling that something isn't right. And this was certainly up there, wasn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Yep. Yeah, there were some alarm bells from the very beginning. But you got to keep that open mind too, don't you? So, yeah.
Absolutely. Because it isn't always as it seems, is it?
No, we've certainly found that out in a lot of the cases that we did. So I remember one that we were – sorry, I'm probably going off track, but I remember one job that we were convinced that a son had murdered his mum, and, we'd arrested him, and lo and behold, wasn't. She'd actually committed suicide and sort of been able to hide her body in an old back shed, and I don't know how many times that shed had been searched, but she sort of concealed herself that much that we was an oversight by not only us but also the local detectives, and lo and behold, there's a suicide note. And as we started working on that, we realised that it wasn't actually the son that killed her, it's actually a suicide. So we had to dust him down and buy him some McDonald's. On your way, son.
I was just going to say, the old...
Do you remember that one?
I think I do, but I think it's funny when you... I do apologise about arresting you and taking you back to the station and accusing you of a murder, Yeah. So would you like a McDonald's and a beer with that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I do. Oh, God. So with this one, remember when it first came in and there, as we both said, that gut instinct, but remember there was a couple of unusual things, like, as you said, the reporting person wasn't actually John in relation to his wife going missing. It was Anna's mum.
And
there was, remember Anna's mum would ring John looking for Anna, and he kept giving her the runaround. And I think we can all appreciate that a mother's intuition, I think we've all learnt you never ever underestimate the power of a mother's intuition, because Anna's mum, remember how adamant she was that there was something wrong?
Yeah.
And yep. And also John, they'd been married for, oh, I don't know, 5 years. She was pregnant with their second child. Like, it just sort of everything appeared sort of nicely tied together. And remember the email that Anna's mum got from John and the flowers for her birthday?
Oh, yeah. It was so not her. It wasn't her writing. The mum knew that it wasn't her writing the email, and it was just, yeah, those things started to add up. They weren't Anna's words. There was no telephone call, which was unusual. So all those sorts of things, you start to think, oh, hello, we need to have a look into this. And I think initially the New Zealand police sort of thought, oh, well, it's, I think their initial thought was, believe sort of John's story that she'd gone off with another man, or not believed it, but, you know, thought it, considered that it was a possibility. And, but it wasn't until the things like the emails and the flowers for the birthday and no telephone calls, that's what sparked the New Zealand police to start thinking, oh, well, we might need to do some checks. So I think they initially did a few checks. Well, they actually did quite a bit of work before it actually came over our way, didn't it?
Yeah. And you might explain why New Zealand was involved.
Yeah, so sorry. Yeah, we because Anna's mum was actually lived in Dunedin, so down South Island, and I think she spoke to Anna regularly, almost every day, or, you know, if it wasn't a phone call, it'd be an email. So when that stopped, and mum kept ringing John to see where Anna was, and yeah, she, as you said before, she just wasn't getting the right sort of answers, and he was just fobbing her off sort of thing. So that, I think she spoke to her priest, and he then spoke to the police at New Zealand. So I can't remember that chap's name, the police officer there, but he was really, he came over in the end.
He did.
Do you remember his name?
No, I don't. Gee, he was a lovely man though.
He was. No. So without his sort of background work and sort of keeping that open mind, I suppose, we wouldn't have been in the position that we were. We were able to sort of act straight away when that file came to us. So I think it was via Interpol it came. So, yeah, so we started doing a bit more of the checks. I mean, he'd rung taxi companies to try and rule out. Well, John had told him on the phone, I think he had a conversation with John on the phone, that Anna had gone off in a taxi, and so he'd rung
The
taxi companies in Mornington. Then there was, I think he'd rung the childcare centre, or there was a couple of, inquiries that he'd done before he'd even put a file together for us. And then when we got it, obviously we were able to do checks on the mobile phone and background checks on them, and nothing sort of stood out. They were what we called clean skins, and just, you know, there was nothing untoward. There wasn't even a family violence report on the system or anything like that. There was, but once the phone checks came in, which is usually one of the first things that you do, was that we noticed that Anna's phone was still being used, and there was money withdrawn from her bank accounts via an ATM. So that's when sort of things weren't adding up. And
that threw a spanner in the works for us, didn't it? when with the mobile being used, didn't it? And the withdrawing of money, because we kept thinking, well, who's using it if she isn't?
And then we got John's statement. I think Kenno took that and just, there was a couple of things that weren't adding up, and I think that's sort of when he became a real suspect. But we had nothing else to prove or disprove the affair theory. We didn't have any, there was no CCTV or anything from the ATMs. There was, but there was obviously questions around why Anna wasn't ringing her mum, or, you know, maybe she was having an affair and he, you know, that she was withdrawing the money. So, but I think the TV interview that John did, who could forget that TV interview, the crocodile tears?
Never
I think we all said I just think we all said that we'd be rich if for every person that said, oh, God, he's done it for sure. Yeah, so he was pleading with Anna to contact him in the crocodile tears, and, yeah, everyone was saying he's done it. We had to get that evidence.
And we didn't have it, did we? We didn't have any evidence to prove or disprove anything. But speaking of evidence, but we did get a nice little piece of evidence after that interview on the TV, didn't we?
Did we ever? God, we were jumping for joy. It was just, we were just lucky. I think at the end of the day, we were really lucky when we had the surveillance dogs on him. And do you remember how we reacted when that happened?
I will never forget that day as long as I live, because just for the listeners and those who haven't heard, we did put the UCs, we put the dogs on John, which means that they're just plainclothes police that follow somebody just to see what they're doing or where they're going. And sometimes we generally put the dogs on people because we're hoping, correct me if I'm wrong here, Kira, but we're hoping that they will lead us to, I don't know, something, whether it be where the bodies are or where they've hidden something or someone. And it doesn't, would you say generally it doesn't work? Like the dogs don't, would you agree with that?
Yeah. You need a bit of luck, and we got some,
Oh, did we what? And what we saw was the dogs watched John, and he went down to he drove to a beach, which was about half an hour away from where he lived at Chelsea, and he drove down to the beach, and this was all on video. The dogs had him driving into the car park. He then left the car. He went behind a toilet block, fossicked around under a bush. He brings out a white plastic bag, and he has a bit of a look around, making sure nobody's watching, and he brings out a mobile phone, and then he makes a call, and then he gets something else out of the bag and he puts it in his pocket. He gets in his car and goes up to the bank, withdraws, puts the a card in the ATM, withdraws some money, goes back to the car, drives it back to the Chelsea beach, puts the bag all nice and neat back under the bush and drives away. And that's when he rang our office. He got back home. This is how I remember it. And he rang our office and he said, I've got some great news. Somebody has just withdrawn some money from the Chelsea ATM and she's just rung me on her mobile. Will you ever forget? We were doing high fives that day, weren't we? Because we knew we had him, didn't we?
And you don't get that often in these sorts of cases. So, yeah, we're certainly doing high fives. And, it was a bit of a breakthrough, that one.
It was, but also it was also an awful feeling as well, because our worst fears were confirmed, really, because the dogs went back to that bag and they found that it was Anna's phone and Anna's card that he had used. So I remember a feeling of dread that day as well, like euphoria in one sense and then dread in the next, you know.
Yeah, this is real, and our thoughts were our fears that he had actually murdered them, yeah, were coming to fruition, I suppose, yeah. Yeah, so there was a lot of, I remember there was a lot of discussion around whether we did have enough to arrest him, which we certainly built up a good circumstantial case, but the problem was that we didn't know where the bodies were, so it's a bit of a catch-22 with these sorts of ones, because do we keep the dogs on him? Will he revisit where he's disposed of them? Or have we got enough to just arrest him, and will he, you know, what are the odds of him telling us what he's done? It's just a really tricky one. So there was all sorts of discussion, and I think at the end of the day it was decided with the video that we had on him and with all the background information that we had, yeah, that it was time to arrest him and see what he had to say. But it's a really, the planning of that, I remember it was extensive, or any interview for that sort of thing is, you really have to cover off on everything. Things like, you know, who's going to be best to interview them, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, so he was arrested and, yeah, he detailed how he did murder Anna and Gracie after a long time of saying that he had nothing to say, and then and how he disposed of their bodies at the Mornington transfer station. So he was charged with the two murders and taken to the watch house for the out of sessions hearing, and appeared in the court one the next morning. And I just, it was an absolute media frenzy. I mean, this had been going on for weeks. So I think since the Crocodile Tears media plea, he was always on the radar of the, I think it was just about front page news just about every day.
The media virtually ran the job in the end, towards the end, didn't they, which is always so dangerous, because they get to people before we do and they can contaminate evidence and do all sorts of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we had to be really careful in managing that, and I don't think I'd been involved in a job that was such a attracted such media. Like, I remember when we drove him to court, there was cameras. We remember the old garage door that you used to drive out of St Kilda Road, and that was, yep, you know, back lane, and there was cameras everywhere, and there was flashes going, and they just wanted a picture of him in the back seat.
Yep.
Yeah, and just, you know, there was cameras stuck. I was in the front seat, so but there was cameras being stuck through the window sort of thing to try and get a glimpse of him. And same at when we arrived at the watch house, and then the next morning at courtroom one, it was just, yeah, absolute media frenzy. And obviously at that time we couldn't give too much detail about what had gone on, because we still needed to find the bodies. So, so it wasn't over. It was only really the beginning, and that's when we established that, from what he told us in the interview, that we established that all the refuse from the Mornington transfer stations then transferred to the Rockley Stone Waste Management Site, it was called, a landfill site. And it was actually at a place called, I'll never forget it, because I thought how apt, how ironic, but remember it was called Devil's Bend at Turong?
Yeah, I do now. I hadn't thought of that like that. Yeah, Devil's Bend.
Thought, oh, how ironic. And just all the work that went into that, the planning for that, it cost, I can't remember what the final figure was, but not that, you know, you'd spend whatever to find the remains of Anna and Gracie, but just the planning. But yeah, so I remember, thankfully, because of the site, because it was asbestos and they had to keep really good records for the EPA sort of factor. So, yeah, again, we were sort of had a bit of luck where they kept records of every load that had come in from different transfer stations, and they could basically pinpoint an area of where deliveries from the Mornington transfer station had come. And then, yeah, obviously that led to the 20-day search. It was 20 days, I remember. And, we found the remains, but of course the first remains that were found by you, my friend, and I will never forget that day.
No, God.
That you found Anna.
No, neither will I. Boy, it's ingrained.
No.
One of those things that you there were so many emotions that day. You know, it gives me chills even thinking about it now. It really does. You could almost just not that I would, but, you know, you could almost just burst out crying thinking about how somebody can be so cruel to somebody else, let alone it being their pregnant wife. It just, you know, defies, you just can't imagine. Yes, but anyway, that day I had my dear friend with me, and in fact I think there's a photo of you and I, and it is so powerful, and it's a photo of you and I sitting on a 44-gallon drum. You know that photo?
Yeah, yep. You showed it in your presentation, actually, yep.
Yep. Oh, my God, and we both got our head in our hands. It was just, 20 days of, you know, and remember you saying that money wasn't an option, but in the end they had to make a decision as to when the last day would be, because I think it was like something like $500,000 a day. It was lot of money. And I found her on the last day, which is even more incredible, but we'll go into that a bit more later. But, there wasn't too many detectives that weren't affected that day, was there?
No. And, what was it, 16 years ago now? But, yeah, you can remember it clear as if it was yesterday. Yep.
I think you've said before that, you know, the boys that we were working with, and most of them were homicide detectives, they were hard and they'd seen everything and done everything. But when it involves a little child and a pregnant lady, any murder is bad, and, you know, let's not forget that. But when you're looking for a little child in a tip, doesn't get much, much harder than that, does it? Ah, gee.
Yeah, yep.
Anyway, so this is when I remember telling that part of the story in my presentation. That's when I remember spotting you in the audience. So you were there with your sister and your niece and your friends. And I'll never forget looking down, because you were like virtually in the front row, God love you. Talk about support your friend. You're always there. In the front row. But, you know, a couple of times I looked down.
I think it was third.
Yeah, family is always first row. But I do remember looking back and thinking to myself, Kira's got her head down, and you just, I don't know, I didn't expect you to be up clapping or anything, but I just thought, what is wrong? Like I couldn't get over, you just looked so sad. And anyway, a few days later we had a chat, didn't we, about the presentation, and you mentioned to me that I might hand this over to you, but you had a very, very unexpected reaction, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. It really took me by surprise, and I think now that, on reflection, it was probably something that I suppose as I'd sort of pushed, I kept pushing away, and then for some reason my reaction just happened to be at your presentation. And it was really weird, because I hadn't – my reaction really surprised me, because I'd never had issues talking about this particular case or listening to others talk about it. I mean, I'd given a few presentations on the case myself. I'd listened to your podcast. I'd seen the show. I think it was Crime Investigation Australia. And never had any real dramas talking about it or listening to it and reflecting. So when I reacted the way I did, it really frightened me, I suppose, and because I'd never sort of had experienced something like that before. And so I remember when the event was advertised, I think you'd give me the heads up. So I'm, all right, yep, I'm going to get some tickets. At that stage, I hadn't even worked out who I was going to ask or whatever. So I just got six tickets. And I should have got more because there was quite a few of my friends and that had to miss out. Even Paul, my husband, had to miss out because my niece really wanted to go. So, yeah, so Paul missed out coming along. And but my niece was really keen to come along. And I think it was the third row. It wasn't the first row that we sat, but I sat between my sister Sandy and Georgina. And I was about five seats in from the aisle. And I didn't actually know what you were going to be talking about. I thought it was going to be something like the podcast on, you know, the reasons why you had PTSD or something along those lines. So I think it was the title just Doing Time with Narelle. Was that the title of the
event? I think so. I don't know if we I think it was just called Doing Time.
So I didn't have an idea of what you were going to be talking about, and not that that would matter anyway. I mean, I still would have, if you had said to me prior to that I'm going to talk about the Mornington job, I would have certainly said, yep, no worries, I'm coming, sort of thing. So, but when you did the introductions of the case that you were going to be talking about, I suddenly had this wave of, it was horrible, like a terrible hot flush. That's the only way I can describe it.
I'm hearing you. I know exactly what you mean.
It was just horrendous. And it just, I felt like I was suffocating. And so it was all very physical reaction. And you hadn't even started talking about the job. All you'd said was, I'm going to be talking about the Mornington Monster. And so from that moment, and Sandy grabbed my hand and she said, are you going to be okay with that? She must have seen that I was sort of having this sort of, I mean, I think I might have taken off, I had a scarf, I was wearing a scarf, I think I'd taken that off, and I tried to just let her know, yeah, I'm going to be fine, but I couldn't. I just, no words could come out. I was using all of my strength just to fight back tears, and all I could do was nod to Sandy that I'm going to be fine, I'm going to be okay, sort of thing. But it was just, but I couldn't stop. One of my leg, I remember my left leg was shaking. I just could not stop it shaking. It was uncontrollable. And just your heart, I mean, my heart, I could feel my heart pounding, and not in a good way. Not like I was in love or anything like that.
Those days are well and truly past.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Bring on hot flushes. Anyway, so I just felt like my heart was going to explode, and I just wanted to get out of there. It was just, I just wanted to get some fresh air, have a howl or something, but it was just a horrible feeling that, because I just didn't have any control over my physical sort of reaction, and I thought, if I get out of here, just compose myself, I'll come back in, or, you know, I'll be able to come back in. But I was trying to work out in my head, how the hell am I going to get out of here without making a scene? And I don't think I was even listening to you at this time. I'm sorry. It was all about me.
I'm so offended.
I just thought I just can't make a scene, and I would have had to have climbed over, you know, five people to get to the aisle, and just I thought, I can't do that. And I don't know how I sort of.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Look, I suppose control back, but I do remember I kept pushing my cuticles back on my fingernails. And I was trying to – I felt like a bit of a druggie, actually, because I was trying to pick off the fluff off my clothes, but it was imagine, you know, how they pick things off your clothes or off their skin or whatever. That's what I was doing to try and, I don't know, occupy my mind or something. And I could hear your voice in the background, but it was like I was in another room, and it was just the weirdest thing and really frightening, to be honest. I'd never experienced anything like that before. So
do you think it was a bit like, say, what they talk about with panic attacks? Do you think that was what it might have been?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd never had anything like that. So, but, yeah, definitely now that you think about it and you've listened to other people's, you know, how they've experienced what a panic attack's like, I think it was like that. So, yeah, it was just all very new to me, and I just couldn't work out why at that moment when I, you know, had 16 years before that of talking about that job multiple times. And, yeah, it was just really, really quite frightening. And then I think finally, I don't know how, but I managed to just, I suppose, just compose myself a little bit. But then I found myself just nodding when you mentioned something that, you know, so I must have been listening, but I just remember, oh, yeah, I do remember that. And obviously you gave a bit of a warning when you were going to talk about how they're actually murdered and gave the option for people to leave. But at that time I thought, well, I knew what was coming. So I sort of, I think by that stage I thought, no, I'm right to sort of just sit there. But yeah, I don't think it was something that I think it was just something that I'd sort of, I don't know, put in the filing cabinet, and all of a sudden the filing cabinet was opened. And yeah.
And but, so yeah, why, when you mentioned the why do you think it was that time that your filing cabinet opened and not I don't know, when you're giving a presentation or you're listening to the podcast, what was it, do you think, about that time?
Yeah, I've wondered that, and I think I'm not sure whether it was because Sandy hadn't heard much of that job because she was living in Queensland at the time, and we sort of hadn't spoken about it much. I mean, I think Sandy had listened to your podcast, but I think the fact that I didn't have any, I don't know, maybe the control, the loss of control, or I was putting on maybe when I was doing those presentations or whatever, I was putting on a front or a, you know, trying to, I was being detective mode, whereas this one I was just audience mode. Does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah, and also
I don't know. What do you?
Yeah, well, I was thinking, because we've spoken about this a little bit, and I was wondering whether it was because you were trapped, that you couldn't get out, Whereas when you listen to a podcast or when you are giving a presentation, that presentation you've got to remain strong. But with the podcast, it's in your own, you know, in your car or when you're out walking. And if it gets too much, you can just turn it off, or if you feel a bit funny or whatever. But on this particular night or day, whenever it was, you were trapped. And I think maybe because your friend was giving the presentation and it was quite an emotional presentation about something that meant so much to both of us. I just think it was maybe the combination of the fact that it was me telling it, that you had been there and you couldn't escape.
Yep. And I didn't have to put my guard up either, because I was sort of in the audience. And I think, the fact that I could relate to exactly what you were saying, and there was people around me that obviously, you know, that were close to me and they were hearing it from a different perspective, I think, I think you might be spot on there, Nuril. And should be a psychologist.
And didn't Sandy at one point, or one of your sisters, hold your hand or something at some point and sort of mouth to you, "I'm so sorry"?
Yeah, towards the end actually. And I think it might have been after you showed the photo.
Yeah.
Of us on the barrel.
Yeah. That was pretty tough. Maybe we should move on. But you're right, that photo, I think they should show that photo, the Black Salmon boys on the site, because I think that photo says 1,000 words.
Oh. It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Oh, we've got our head in our hands. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just, I think, and as you said before, we just couldn't fathom. We were just so sad and so gobsmacked that someone could do such an awful thing, evil thing to another human being, but let alone your own daughter. It just, because she didn't fit into his story. That was the only reason he murdered Gracie.
Because he didn't know what to do with
her. She did not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think, we just could not fathom that, and that we're in this tip, this awful, what a horrible, horrible place to be, you know, your last place to be. And so thank God we found them. Well, thank you. Thank God you found them. Just so that they could be taken away from that horrible place, because it was awful. It was a horrible, horrible place to be.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was windy. It was raining. It was wet. It was cold. We had on these Anyway, I was going to go on with something there, but I wanted to talk about that we've spoken in depth, obviously, just over the past month or so about this to prepare for today. And I just think it's interesting that some of the things that you remembered that I wasn't aware of and I'd just forgotten about. Can you tell us a few of those memories that we were sort of laughing about the other day?
Yeah, we should have pressed record on that day.
Yeah, we should have, shouldn't we?
Just those little things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just little things. I mean, obviously there was the things that you spoke about in your presentation, but the lead up to the right timing of the arrest, which I mentioned before, I just remember that was prominent for me. And I think in the end, because of the way our teams were made up, we complemented each other's skills, I suppose. But in the end, it was decided that that Kenno and Rocky would do the interview, and I was secretly relieved, because I mean, I obviously wasn't as experienced as Rocky and Kenno, but I think, and we went with them, we just, I think the, having a female on the interview was counted out quite early because it would be counterproductive because of the way, what the intel that we gathered on John. And so that was early days that there wouldn't be a female on the interview team, thank God, because I just don't know how I would have, not only, I think I was not experienced with those sorts of jobs at that time, I don't think, but I don't think I would have coped with the pressure of trying to find where the bodies were and to get a positive result and then just, but to stay professional, I just don't think I would have been able to do it. And then to see that interview with Rocky and Kenno, I just, oh my God, they, it was just, I don't know how they did it. And then, I mean, they had daughters themselves, how they contained themselves and just stuck to the task and managed to engage with John Sharp to get him to a point where he actually started saying where he, how he killed Anna and Gracie and where he disposed of the bodies. But we did talk about how the plan didn't work at first because John was saying nothing. So we had to revert to plan B, which was, yeah, it was actually one of the things that I won't forget because it wasn't the most, what would I say, enjoyable task. But I, on the day of the arrest, John's parents, Valerie and Miles, I mean, obviously we'd been to their house because that's where John was staying. We executed a search warrant, so it was all pretty horrible for them. But they were desperate to come in and follow us in. And they wanted to make sure he was okay. But I had to sit with them in that, you remember that little couch in the foyer of the homicide squad?
Oh,
there was that little,
yes.
As you came out of the lifts and there was that tiny room that led into, so everyone's walking through and there's this tiny two-seater couch.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was all the only place we could put them because they were, I mean, they were freaking out. But we had to try and, I suppose, get them on side to make them see that this is real, John. This is what we think John's done. We need to find where he's buried, or how he's disposed of the bodies. And because the couch was so small, so Valerie and Miles are sitting on the couch, and I ended up sitting on the arm of the couch, trying to engage with them. It was not
conducive, was it?
It was difficult.
No.
No. Yeah. In hindsight, we should have planned that a little bit better, but. Anyway, we had people walking past, and sometimes you can engage in that sort of situation. You're able to engage with people easier than others, and I was finding it very difficult to engage with them. But I had to really keep them on side, I suppose, to try and convince them that this is what we believe's happened, but we need to know where the bodies are, sort of thing, and. But, yeah, I'll never forget, Valerie had brought in a sandwich for John. She was worried that he wasn't eating, and I tried to assure her that, you know, we'd offered him refreshments and that sort of thing, and that she brought in this sandwich. It was like a school lunch order. It had, I think it might have been a peanut butter sandwich. I'll never forget this.
Oh, grow up, John.
Peanut butter sandwich.
Yeah.
Yep. With in the brown paper bag, and a little serviette folded in a triangle. So I just, and she wanted to give it to him, and I just thought, oh God. Anyway, and that was at the stage where we weren't getting anywhere with John. So and that we had a bit of a powwow, and yeah, the sandwich became sort of okay. Well, you can go and give him the sandwich, but can you have a chat to him? And it was a big risk, but yeah, it paid off.
I know what I would have done with the sandwich, but anyway.
Yeah. So, So she, he had his sandwich and had a chat to Mum and Dad, and yeah, after that, Rocky and Kenno went back in, and that's when he started saying what had actually happened. And do you remember that room behind the interview rooms that? Where the cameras were, so it was sort of it was set up so that the interviews could be recorded, but you could have a view the interview.
Yeah.
and it was all hooked up with audio and all that sort of thing. So you could watch the interview real life, but yeah, it was like a TV show really, wasn't it?
It was.
Like SVU or something.
Yep.
With it.
Yep.
Yeah. So, but it was a long, narrow room and it just had audio equipment. And I think it was like used as a bit of a storeroom as well. And it was a long, I think that it was a couple of chairs in there. But, and usually when you had interviews, you know, the team might be watching the interview. But that day it was standing room only, wasn't it? It was just jam packed. There was, people popping in and out. Lots of bosses wanting to know, you know, has he fessed up yet? Has he fessed up? But when we were watching it and to hear him, the way he spoke about so coldly about how he killed them and then what he did with them, just you could hear a pin drop. It was just gasps. I remember hearing someone had a gasp of, you know, and there was lots of holy swearing, I won't say. But yeah, I remember some of the old bosses, or not the old bosses, but the bosses that had been there for a long time. It had seen so many gruesome homicides and heard about so many things. They were just floored as well. They just were shaking their heads.
Yeah. I remember, do you remember Luch Rovers? And he came in and there was somebody sitting next to me and he put his hand, he was standing behind us all, and he put his hand on another detective's shoulder just to sort of say, you know, how you doing? And I'll never forget thinking, God, I hope he doesn't do that to me because I would have absolutely lost it.
Yeah.
Remember the toilet scene?
Yes. I think that might have been just before the toilet scene when I looked over at you and you were just shaking your head, don't look at me, don't look at me, because yeah. I reckon I'd already started. I just, I think we RV'd in the ladies' loo and, just started. Oh, I remember I just could not fathom what we were hearing, and I think we were a little bit, you know, trying to be that strong, tough detective, but once we're in the, you know, the privacy of the female's toilet, I think, just let loose. And
I can remember putting my head in my hands, or the two of us putting our head in our hands, and just like, oh my God, like I knew that what he'd done must have been bad, but I just hearing him speak and tell Rocky and Kenno with no emotion whatsoever about, remember the spear guns and how he took them out and put them back in. And, I could hardly bear it.
The fact that, you know, I put a towel over their head because I couldn't bear to look at them. It made me angry. I was so angry. And then he was just talking as if when he was talking about chainsaw Anna's body up. I mean, and was just talking about it with an everyday occurrence.
Like he'd been out in the woodyard and just cut a bit of wood.
You are a monster.
Mm, yeah, he was. Yeah, you were right. And then, as if that's not bad enough, then there's the tip search. Oh my God. Oh yeah, I think we covered the tip search before, but that was bad.
I remember the first, I mean, again, it was a media frenzy, but I think by this stage, obviously, it had been released that the bodies had been disposed at the site. So it was a media frenzy again. And we're all very positive, you know, we had our shiny new protective suits and goggles and masks and and rakes and shovels and so much planning had gone into this site. It was all very, you know, oh, off we go, hi-ho, hi-ho, off to work we go sort of thing. And then, oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was so cold. I remember it was the depths of winter. It was so – but the wind was so icy. And I remember I kept layering up. I kept putting – layer on layer because I was so cold, and in the end I had that many layers on and it was such an ordeal to go to the loo that I actually stopped drinking because I didn't want to have to go to the loo. Because when you had to go to the loo, you had to take everything off. And remember, we had to wash our – you had to go up to the top of the site and take all your suits off, protective gear off, and then wash your boots and but it was just but it was that roller coaster feeling of when you see like a – because we'd been given so much detail by Sharp about, you know, how he put them in a – there was a couple of blue sports bags and blue tarps. So every time, you know, you saw something blue, your heart would skip a beat, and then the bucket of the bulldozer would sort of, you know, carefully place all the shit, you know, all the refuge on the ground, and then we had to sort of search through it, and then and you get your hopes up when you saw a blue tarp or a blue bag, and then you open it up thinking, yep, this is it, and then it was just full of nappies or something very smelly, and then, you know, you go back to, and then the next bucket load, you go, oh, this is it, this is going to be it. So, but, yeah, so I think that's why it was so monumental, the day that you found Anna, and I can remember exactly where I was standing, because I was actually – I had a very important role that day, Narelle. I was safety officer.
I don't remember anything about that day other than fine.
So I got to wear a vest.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I had the reflective vest on that day because of all the asbestos and everything, but we had – because, remember, it was so noisy. It was all the
– couldn't hear.
Or the wind, but the bull – no, you couldn't. So we had this sort of plan that the safety officer would be stand next to the bulldozer so that the bulldozer driver would be in sight of them, and then the safety officer could see if he needed to stop sort of digging or and if there was any asbestos, then the asbestos people had to come in and hose it all down and everything. But
I
was up the top of the – so it was a big pit, I suppose. We were working in pits, and so I was up the top near the bulldozer driver, and the signal came to stop. I looked down, all I could see was you jumping up and down. You were jumping up and down, waving your arms about, and I signaled to the driver to stop. And then I noticed that everyone sort of had congregated around you, and you were pointing to something, and, you know, everyone's heads were nodding, and all the shovels and the rakes were sort of thrown out, you know, put down. And so I knew it wasn't a false alarm. I just thought there's something there. And because I was on top of the pit, it took me a while to sort of scurry down. I think I actually remember falling down and slipping a couple of times because I was so eager to get there. But when I finally got there, you were just, you were beside yourself. I remember I couldn't see what everyone was pointing at. I just couldn't see it. And I remember you took me in and showed me, and you said, see, and pointed out and what looked like a kitchen glove. It was just like a kitchen glove. And I just remember thinking, how the hell did you pick that up? Because I just reckon I wouldn't have. It was just, it was just unbelievable. I think you were just meant to find Anna that day. It was just.
You know, Kira, funny you say that, but this will sound really bizarre. But I was that determined that day, or not that day, I was just determined to find them. And I thought that I would. I don't know how I can say that, but I actually thought I would find either her or little Gracie. I don't know what it was, a sixth sense, whatever you call it. Yeah. And then I rang. Yeah. I tried to ring Rocky.
Yeah, because Rocky wasn't at the site that day. We had to obviously roster people on and off and that sort of thing, but he wasn't there that day. But yeah, I remember you. But we had to take the masks off to talk. So I remember we were standing there and we were waiting for crime scene to come down, and because it was so windy and. Yeah, it was hard to make a phone call. It was hard to get a signal, I think. But, yeah, you rang him. And And I don't think Rocky could hear you because all you were saying, I found her, Rocky, I found her, I found Anna, and you were screaming it. But because of the wind and everything, and I could hear him on the other side going, what? Yeah, what the? So I remember I had to take the phone from you and actually interpret because
I was just overcome.
You were so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were. Yeah. And yeah, he was. And obviously, yeah, it was just. We knew from that day that we were getting close. So, and it was only, it wasn't all of Anna, unfortunately. There was still, because he chopped her up with a chainsaw. So, we obviously knew that we were getting, if we'd found some of Anna, well, Gracie was around there somewhere as well. So, yeah, so the search continued because I think that morning they were considering calling it quits. So, and I think a couple of days later, I think it was the morning that I had a massive meltdown at home. I was just, we'd been going probably 2 weeks by this stage, and I was just so exhausted. I just could not pull myself out of bed when the alarm went off. I just didn't have any energy. I was, just drained. And I just kept trying to, I was saying, I can't go. I just can't go. And this is to Paul. And I got frustrated with him because he says, well, don't go then. And I go, no, you don't understand. I have to go. He goes, no, you don't. If you're not feeling up to it, don't go. And I said, no, I have to go. And I tried to justify it by saying that I had the car, so I had to pick up two other members on the way. And, I didn't want to be that person that put their hand up to say I wasn't coping. I did not want to be that person. And so, yeah, somehow, I don't know how, to this day, how I actually mustered the courage to get back in the, all the old clothes we had to wear underneath the layers, and then somehow I got there. But I'm glad I did, because that day we found, so Ben and Fish found the other part of Anna's torso, and yeah, so that's I'm sort of glad I did that day. But that day was quite a late day because I did the escort to the morgue. And one of the things that I'll never forget was that I walked into that back office at the morgue, and they said, "Oh my God, you stink!" And I hadn't noticed. Apparently, I had not noticed, but I just they were like walking backwards, trying to get away from me because I stunk. And then when I got home, all said the same thing. He's just like, oh my God. And you could smell it in the car. And yeah, so I ended up burning my clothes that day. That was the only way we could get rid of the smell. And it was just all the smells that you came across. But yeah, that particular day,
I think we ended up burning the clothes or throwing them out or something. Oh, they were putrid. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I get a bit of a sniff of the same sort of smells. Whenever I go to the transfer station here, it's funny, every time I go there, I think of that, not just the smell, but the fact that when I'm putting something in one of those bins at the transfer station, it always takes me back. How could someone put a body in there, just throw a body in? Every time I go to a bin like that, I just think, it brings me back to how the hell could you do that? There's some smells that, you just never forget. And, especially the nappies. I don't know how many disposable nappies we found. Oh, my Lord. And
too many.
We had
too
to
many.
Look at every bag. Oh, my God. Yeah. Yep. And even though we had masks on, those bloody masks. I mean, people are complaining about wearing masks these days. Oh my God! Those masks were suffocating.
They were terrible.
Filter things on it. But there was two types, and I remember the first type was, I ended up ditching them because I just felt I couldn't breathe. But they had those sort of two filters on each, one on each side, and they kept filling up with my own saliva. It was disgusting. It was just, and I was swimming in my own saliva sort of thing. And I kept having to take it off and empty it. And yeah, just every couple of minutes you'd have to empty it. And I thought, yeah, so I ended up going with another mask. So I'm certainly not complaining about wearing the mask we have to these days, that's for sure.
No, it's nothing compared to that, is it? But, look, I think we might finish on that, Kira. It's been fascinating and, yeah, incredible, as you say, to think somebody can do that to his own family. But, look, what I'd like to do is finish up now and but I'd like you to come back if you could. And talk about a case, we'll do a case study, which won you the salubrious title of policewoman or police person of the year in 2002. Is there a brief sentence that you could tell the listeners so that they get a bit of an idea of what you won that award for?
Oh, well, a brief sentence, yeah. It was an interesting one. So it was an old cold case. Where a woman slowly poisoned her husband with arsenic, and so it was an excruciating, painful death. But it stumped all the doctors, and then until some mislaid results of hair and nail samples reappeared, but it was too late. It was the day before he died. So she was charged with his murder, but at inquest it was found to be insufficient evidence. So the charge was dropped, and then 15 years later the case was reopened when it came across my desk. So yeah, it's an interesting one. It was had all sorts of bits and pieces to it, but yeah, so you know, I'd be happy to have a chat about that because that's a successful one. Yeah. Whereas a lot of the others are still unsolved.
Yeah, you're right. So we might, we'll get you back to give us a case study on that. But look, thank you so much for your time today. I have no doubt that that's given people a bit more of an insight as to, you know, it's a tough job at times, a job we love, but we're like anybody. They affect us as is clear today. But thanks for your time, Kira, and we'll look forward to your next instalment. Thank you.
Thanks for the chat.
Hey, it's Narelle here again. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcasts as much as we enjoy putting them together. But to make sure you never miss an episode of Narelle Fraser Interviews, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and even a review. And please share it with all your friends too. And again, thanks for joining us. We have got some amazing stories to tell. So thanks again. See ya. Hello, guess who? Just a quick interruption here to let you know you can now become a Narelle Fraser Interviews Patreon. How exciting! Simply go to www.patreon, that's P for Peter, A-T-R-E-O-N for Narelle.com and search for Narelle Fraser Interviews. And to all of you out there who continue to support me, thank you so much.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.